I might start with a question for all of you. One of the traits of the modern workforce is that employees, particularly younger generations, are likely to change jobs and careers many times. The question is, are our schools, vocational higher education institutions prepared for this paradigm? And would each of you like to highlight any particular skills that you think we need to equip students with to adjust to this future career prospect?
We're on, aren't we? Yes, we are. Look, Robert, I think it's very important when you address this discussion to not think that we need to be drawn in by throw the baby out with the bathwater sort of whiz-bangery. Yes, you're absolutely right. Students will change jobs. Young people will change jobs much more frequently than I have, much more frequently than you have. They will need all sorts of adaptability. You can already see when you talk to your own kids that they're much more flexible. They don't think about having a job for 30 or 40 years, so they will need to dip back in and out of education, be it university, be it vocational, be it any sort of post-school education. I think the system we have now is not doing a bad job at all of providing loads of options. Doesn't mean we can't move and change and get better, but I think it is a furphy to think that there is some sort of inherent rigidity in the system currently, because that's not true. I think universities are, and I would say this about other forms of education as well, are actually pretty good at disrupting things. I mean, you want to look around the country at the people who are the edgiest, the thinking out of the box the most. I'm looking down at Jane Golly here deliberately. But many people, our leading academics, really push the envelope, and they are the people who are setting the standard inside institutions that teach students how to think as well as fill them up with a whole lot of facts. I think that sets young people up with an extremely good toolbox to draw from. I think there are some structural things we can do to make the sort of transition between bits of education better and easier, but it is very important to be careful about the way you do that so that you don't underestimate the importance of long, hard, contemplative study and the sort of study you get through not just doing something short. Doing something short is good for particular things, but for really gaining sustained knowledge and the kind of knowledge employers want, the sort of creative thought, the sort of elastic brain, the sort of adaptability, the sort of resilience that we need in a really massively, rapidly changing workforce. That was a very long answer, sorry.
Okay. Yep. Well, let's see if Leanne and Katie want to just add quickly to it.
Thanks, Robert. Look, I will. I definitely endorse your comments. It's about doing more of what we're already doing really well as institutions in this sector, across all of the various sectors. One thing I will say, though, is that I think as a sector, we can do more of understanding that the world of hyperconnectivity creates different domains of complexity for all of us. And so I think the nuancing around how to apply information and knowledge to those various multiple contexts that the world of work now has is something we need to continue to do more of in that space.
I certainly very much agree with you, Leanne. I guess the other thing probably to kind of add to the debate, Robert, is that research that tells us that young people will have many, many careers, 17 in one lifetime, I think the Foundation for Young Australians says, also tells us, though, that they will tend to spend their career in particular clusters. And so whether it's in a services cluster or whether it's in a science and engineering cluster. And so the content is still very important. But the other thing that's really important that we are working on in schools is thinking about what are the skills, what are the dispositions and capabilities that go alongside that content that create young people who are ready for the workforce. And what I've heard employers saying is that as well as the content, they're also looking for the capabilities like creative and critical thinking, like intercultural understanding, as one of the earlier speakers spoke about, problem solving and working in teams. And those are, in fact, aspects that are running through horizontally through our curriculum in the schools at the moment to try to meet those needs of the future workforce.
might just add to that. I think it's really fascinating, and you made the point, Trina, about being careful that we don't fall into the categorisation of things and isolation of things, that we do explore the ambiguity of the connections between the things. And to that end, I'd just say that notion of institutions, sometimes generally we think about just young people, but more and more in addition to that, because it is the end, that transition of all of the workforce, particularly in an ageing nation, and a global economy as well, that need to continually transition not just the young people, but all people in the workforce as well.
Can I follow on with it's related but slightly separate, slightly new direction question to you, Katie. So teachers in any of the sectors, the three of you responsible for, obviously lie at the heart of education, there's been many and sometimes constrained debates about, you know, the role of teachers and the closed box of the teaching sort of interface. What can policymakers and education ministers do to empower teachers, encourage teachers to continue professional development and keep up with the challenge in their profession?
That's a really important question because, as you're pointing out, Robert, the things that make a difference in a child's educational outcomes, 50% of them, as we all know, really are in the home, and the other 50% in the school, and the majority of the school factors relate directly to the teaching in the classroom. And so those professionals are the most important part of how we can influence and improve children's educational outcomes. What we know from the best systems in the world are that there are three things that are required to have a teaching workforce, a professional teaching workforce that has the capacity and the opportunity to change and continue to grow. One is a focus on inquiry, so constantly looking and examining their practice. The second is an approach to collaboration. And the third, which underpins it, is a what's called open to learning approach. And there's ways that we see this manifested in ACT schools today where groups of teachers work together and observe their colleagues and then provide constructive feedback on how the teaching and learning is occurring in the classroom. To do that, you need high levels of trust, and you also need to give professionals the time to build the models and the skills to undertake that really complex professional practice together. And I think that's where the role of policymakers comes in, providing those constructs. And here in the ACT, for example, we're also from June this year going to ensure that all primary teachers have an additional 30 minutes of planning time, which they can spend together doing that kind of deep professional inquiry and collaboration. So I think that's where the system comes in, is really about enabling what we know the professionals need to make a difference.
Thanks.
Can I just add to that? I know I'm universities rather than schools, but it's hard not to see that we before us have a very good example in Canberra of a really high-functioning school system. And all those things you've just described so carefully and so interestingly are also about one other thing. They're about resourcing. So there's enough money. There's enough money for there to be, in a school I'm very familiar with, a senior teacher above a whole bunch of other teachers, keeping up with the latest research in relation to a whole bunch of fields. So there's enough resource, there's enough time for teachers to be able to really embed themselves in the things they are teaching the kids and do all those fantastic innovative things. It's really hard to do that if you're in a high school in the western suburbs of Melbourne that I'm also very familiar with, where they just haven't got any money. Everything's vandalised, the class sizes are twice as big. I mean, it's a real challenge for policymakers, but surely we have some examples of things working beautifully, and we see the results in our kids here. You know, can't we just sort it out?
Thank you. Leanne, question for you. In the first session this morning, really interesting sort of presentations on a whole range of things, productivity, agenda, the three P's were central. And when we drilled down to, well, what does this mean, one of the points that was up there sorting out vocational education and training for the nation. So I guess, given your long leadership sort of and thought, deep thought about this sector and your responsibility for the sector locally, I guess first, how important, what do you actually make of the, you know, oft-cited need for connection to industry? What does that mean locally and the economy? And what are some of the clues that you might give us for the way forward that gives sort of meaning to that almost slogan, you know, make vocational education work now? It's not been a brilliant decade.
That's a big question. For those of you in the room who are familiar with the vocational education and training sector, you'll definitely understand the context of Robert's question. Yes, I think, could I answer it with a couple of different hats if I could? So let me start by answering it with my hat as the CEO of the Canberra Institute of Technology, which has been acknowledged as one of the top three large registered training organisations in the country twice over the last 3 years, which is no small feat when you're looking at some 4,500 providers in Australia in this sector. The sector in Canberra, and you heard from the Chief Minister this morning, although I wasn't in the room, I was at the corridor listening very carefully to the Chief Minister's comments. And I think both Katie and Katrina really focused on this incredible opportunity and prosperity opportunities that we have in Canberra. CIT reflects that because we are advantaged by the size of our jurisdiction. We're really advantaged by the connectivity that size gives us. So if you look across the school sector, the universities, and then VET, and particularly the institutions, and the reason why, of course, I've got a bias about the label of institutions, because my bias is that in a really mixed VET sector of over 4,000 providers, it is TAFE that is the education institution in that sector, and yet the struggle for us as an institution of education in that sector is that from a regulatory and legislation, policy, funding setting, we are often thought of at the national level in the whole of the sector as just another registered training organisation. So it's a complex space for us, it's very messy for us, and unfortunately over the last number of years, the general public are well. I can understand why the public thinks that the VET system is in a huge mess. I can reassure you that the system at large is very messy and complex. But here in Canberra, the connections that we've got across the ecosystem, and that's a really important word for us. We take our responsibility with the institutions that are our colleagues and with the industry that we're serving as an ecosystem. We don't isolate and categorise. Wherever we can, we think about those connections between the sector. Those connections for us in CIT, in the VET sector, are critical in that connection to industry. You may not know that the, if you like, curriculum that CIT teaches, that all vocation education and training institutions deliver, that curriculum is developed by industry. It's called a training package. The training package, the units of competency that are in those training packages are absolutely formulated by many of you in the room through your various advocacy and lobby and informational spaces that you contribute into. You absolutely dictate what happens in the classroom every day, although you may not realise that because of that, you know, the arm's length sort of connection. So that connection to industry is absolutely critical for us. If we're not of value to you, then we are not of value to individual students, and we are not of value to the community that we serve. So for us, that connection is really important. It's somewhat easier for us in Canberra because of our size. But you heard the Chief Minister this morning talking about the diversity in the ACT economy and how the states and territories are the doers in that comparison to the Commonwealth in terms of the policy settings as well. So it's an incredibly large responsibility for the institutions like CIT, the universities and the school system here in the ACT to connect up, to make sure that we are meeting those rapidly changing needs of many of the businesses that you represent, and so that we can make sure the graduates that you're taking on from institutions like CIT are really meeting the skills that you need for now, but more and more the skills that all of us are going to need into the future as well. So the industry connections that we've got are fantastic. We can do more. We'd like to see institutions that are the TAFE institutions in the education sector at the table at the Commonwealth level a lot more, so we can help design those educational pieces that we know are going to be needed as fundamental aspects of the system going forward as well.
I'm going to take the advantage of being up here to tell the audience an anecdote. I was facilitating a meeting involving all the universities and CIT with the health ministry here and the health provider organisation, and there was this quiet moment when suddenly one of the clinical leaders out of Canberra Health Service started pondering the importance of getting adaptability into the workforce, and told us a story about when they were doing chronic disease planning and trying to work at how they could improve the health outcomes for people with long-term chronic metabolic illness. And they had a real problem with people with edema, with lower leg swelling. And suddenly he says, wow, I never thought about the implications of this educationally, but one of the nurses suggested, we trotted down to CIT and you changed the curriculum for people doing massage therapy to learn how to bandage properly, and suddenly we had a service in Canberra for people who otherwise suffer pain and other adverse health consequences. And so he was saying, we leaders in the health system need to stop thinking just about health faculties, medical faculties.
Yeah. So I think that awareness is always a challenge for us in a fairly complex, competitive sort of space. But if you think about at CIT, the ability for us to adapt and put out into the market incredibly short timeframes, new programs for cybersecurity, renewable energy, solar, sustainable practices, allied health, yep, and particularly the responses to the NDIS, just a couple of examples of where TAFE in particular, but you know, here in Canberra, we're absolutely, the Chief Minister said this morning about the innovation that's led by this government and the support for institutions like CIT, absolutely national leading, in some areas, particularly renewable energies, global leading. It might be a bit of a quiet secret that your local TAFE is absolutely at the forefront of that leadership, both across Australia and in some areas globally as well.
Can I just tease out one area we also talk a lot about on the inside about in education, but be interesting to talk to a broader audience engaged in business, the economy. What is the future of the relationship between the vet sector and the university sector? And any of you might have a view on that.
What a tiny question, Robert. Yeah. I think one thing that is not commonly understood, that there are very good connections between vocational education and universities already. There are all sorts of interconnections. We're just about to put out a glossy booklet with examples of all the connections between all 39 comprehensive universities and a huge range of TAFE enterprises. This is not only one-way stuff either. It isn't just someone doing something at TAFE then moving up to university, because it isn't that at all. It's often people doing something at university, a bit of something at TAFE or other vet, then coming back in. There is quite a lot of interchange between the sectors, and that's a really virtuous thing because they are different offerings. I mean, I think that's really important to emphasise. Industry also plays an enormously important part in that. We did the first study of its kind last year on the number of work-integrated learning. It's a terrible description of experiences for university people doing something in industry. It's called WILL. Ugh. That, there are 500,000 of them. The year we surveyed, there were 500,000 instances of that. All the feedback from students was that their experience in industry, whether it was long, short, for credit, not for credit, was fantastically good. And studies that Andrew Charlton has done on our behalf indicate that the one thing that increases your chances of getting a job and getting a job related to your discipline and getting it quickly is doing one of those things, doing a WILL placement, doing a placement in industry of some sort. So universities are all for this. The only thing we'd say to you in the room and to your colleagues around the country is help us with more of them. We can't create them without industry. It's just they are absolutely invaluable across a huge range of disciplines. Just some experience in the workplace, some interaction with the workplace is really, really hugely important for all sorts of different kinds of education.
Look, I couldn't agree more, and I think your point's such a good one about it's not one intersection, it's multiple intersections. So, you know, forget that linear sort of lockstep progress. It's not one, then the next, then the next. It's this network of neural kind of, you know, visual sort of mapping that happens all the time, and it's not just a linear sort of path. I think... you're right, we've got some fantastic examples across here in Canberra with the universities in childcare, allied health, aged care, cybersecurity, renewable energies, and those programs are just growing more and more, and the collaboration with industry so that industry can have multiple sector students in your workplaces at the same time from the universities and from CIT is a growing opportunity that we're working with many of you on already, and I think there's more we can do there. Another connection point or intersection between the schools, universities and CIT here in Canberra is through the government's recognised injection to create the Canberra Innovation Network. And if you're not familiar with the Canberra Innovation Network, it's an incredibly fascinating space for the education institutions to come together to cooperate. All the universities and CIT are foundation members of the Canberra Innovation Network, and that is creating for us new opportunities to connect up and support all of our students from all of the sectors that are on the panel this morning, to support entrepreneurs and startups and those students who more and more are actually going to be creating industries and businesses for themselves as opposed to going into the existing businesses and industries that are in the ACT community. Encourage you to try and get involved and understand about those new networks that are happening in Canberra as well outside the institutions that we're all connected to in that innovation network is fantastic.
Robert, I think kind of just briefly to really reinforce, I think the notion that both Leanne and Katrina have put about getting away from that idea of a hierarchy and rather seeing the post-school world as a series of opportunities and networks. And, you know, I reflect on this quite often. I think that sometimes we tend to overlook that one of the most radical and successful policy changes over the last 20 years has been the significant increase in the number of young people who complete school, who stay on to year 12, and that's been the result of a range of different policy shifts, which has shifted the number of young people completing school by a very significant percentage. The result of that is that it's absolutely crucial that the pathways that are then available for them reflect the diversity of the young people who we have, through our policy and our service provision, encouraged and supported to stay on in education. And the reason that they're staying on needs to be because we then have the offering for them, whether it is to pick up their vocational interests or go on to the university or to move back and forth between them, as has just been described. This is, I think, one of the things that we can see in Canberra being lived out in our college system. And I had the great privilege of going to a number of the graduations at the end of last year and seeing the achievement of young people in their vocational subjects being celebrated equally alongside of their academic achievements. And we then need to see that reflected in our view of the post-school world. And I think that's exactly what we're describing here today.
Fantastic, thank you. We could go on talking up on stage all day probably, but we should give an opportunity to people in the audience who want to ask a question. And while you think about what that might be, that's fantastic. Gives me a chance to ask Katie one more quick question. So given your passion for social justice and equity outcomes, and clearly that's part of what's driven you into education because we're better, as the Chief Minister said, this is a very affluent town with very high participation rates, but it's not a town where there's no disadvantage, and not every young person is living in an ideal situation. I'd just be interested in your thoughts as you've got your head around Canberra a bit more in the ACT as to what your equity kind of agenda might be in ACT education. Noting we've got your head of community services sitting just over there, a long-time education person, Rebecca Cross, so the two of you might have quite a bit to talk about.
We do. Robert, it won't surprise you, given that you and I first worked together on early childhood reform, yes, to say that the biggest impact we can have on equity of educational outcomes and, in fact, life outcomes is through continued early childhood reform. And the Chief Minister mentioned that, and that's introducing three-year-old preschool is one of the things that I'm responsible this year. But the I'm drawing on the aphorism that strategy without numbers is just poetry, which I really loved earlier today. There's some pretty amazing numbers behind early childhood, which sometimes they're so incredible, I think perhaps they almost get glossed over. But early childhood is probably the most efficient investment that a government can make. Every dollar invested in quality early childhood education results in between $2 and $4 of productivity. And the evidence suggests that children who have high quality early childhood will not only get better school results, they will also be more likely to complete year 12 and have less or minimal call on government services in later life. And I think that's been costed at around a saving to government of about $700,000 per person. So the biggest thing we can do to improve equity, both of educational outcomes and broader equity in terms of participation productivity, is investment in early childhood. And I think it's very exciting to come to the ACT at a time when that is continuing and is a big part of the future of education.
Thank you. Question over there.
Eric Bagshaw from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. I want to take you to an issue that's really affecting a lot large parts of the education sector, and that is the coronavirus outbreak.
Eric, I thought there was going to be an hour in my day when I wasn't going to have to talk about coronavirus. It's so nice to see you two can take this question.
And thank you very much for your panel discussion. And sorry to interrupt it with this issue. Firstly, I want to ask how lasting is the potential damage to our reputation from some of the measures that the Australian government has taken, which are significantly over and above what the British and Canadian governments have taken. And secondly, as a whole, are we too overexposed to the Chinese market, and does this particular situation show that out? And finally, what do we say to the thousands of students who are now stuck in China, many of whom their families have saved for years to send them here, only for us to tell them that right now we don't really want them?
I think, Katrina, you have to.
I think that's one for me. Thank you so much, Eric. Okay. So there were three questions there, weren't there? So the first one, remind me, the first one is?
What's the damage? Is there going to be lasting damage from this decision that the Australian government has taken, which is?
And you're also keen on hearing about what our view about the medical authorities is. So every decision the government has made about travel restrictions in relation to the coronavirus has been made on the explicit high-quality advice of chief medical officers from the Commonwealth, the states and territories. This is very well-founded advice, and universities will not at any level be quibbling with it. We're taking meticulously that advice on board and making as many options available for those students as we possibly can. Those people who haven't spent the last week and a half thinking about nothing other than coronavirus might be a little surprised by this set of questions, but there are around 100,000 Chinese students currently in China or third countries who can't come to Australia right now because of a travel ban, because of the virus. What will we say to them? We would say, we really want to see you back as soon as it's safe for you to come back. every university in the country is working 24 hours a day to make as many options available to those students as is possible. For some, that'll be some online study while they're sitting at home and waiting to get here. For some, that'll be deferring the start of their studies. For some, that will be all sorts of other options. The feeling we are getting from Chinese students now that we have actually managed to make contact with almost all of them, that was a big enough task in itself. They're adults, they don't ask if they can go home for Lunar New Year, so finding them has been something that the Commonwealth Government has really helped us with. The feeling we are getting from them is the thing they want to do most is have some kind of certainty. They are clearly dealing with an enormous amount of uncertainty, an enormous amount of stress. They're worried about their health, their families. The Chinese students who are here, a significant number also, are also very concerned at what's going on at home. They're also really keen to get on with it. Do you think I've answered all three quite? Not quite. China's a very big country. I can't believe I have to keep on saying this. 1.3 billion people with the largest middle class of any country in the world. Anywhere Chinese students choose to study, they will be very substantially represented. 140 different countries. 140. That's the range of countries that our universities draw their students from. Diversification is something that is embedded in the DNA of every single Australian university. We draw from a huge range of places. We're close to China. We're a great place to study. We're a beautiful country to be in. Why wouldn't people want to be here and study, and why wouldn't they want to be here in numbers? Coronavirus doesn't just affect us here. It affects all sorts of industries around Australia, but this is something the world is dealing with, not just the Australian education system, not just the Australian economy, not just the Australian tourism sector. Sorry to everyone else, that really was a question that was not about what we're here to discuss today.
Leanne, do you want to make
it? Sure. Look, question one, two and three, absolutely ditto what Katrina just said. Thank you. At a smaller scale from an institution here in Canberra. But just to give a great example of exactly what you're saying, at my institution, last week I welcomed students from up to 86 different countries.
Question, Ben.
So I hope I'm not jumping in. Kevin Earle from Engineers Australia, where education, STEM, gender balance is pretty important to us. And I noticed Andrew Barr's made a comment about the infrastructure investment and upgrade and refurbishment schools in the coming budgets. I was pleased that a comment was made about education and it being part of an ecosystem. I wondered to what extent our facilities and infrastructure investments actually support that outcome. Certainly what I see is a range of standalone buildings, standalone facilities, access. It's an independent system as opposed to a combined ecosystem. I wonder if I could ask you to comment on that.
Happy to start a response to that. Look, I get visually that it looks like that because when you drive past the various infrastructure bricks and mortars, you get a sense that it's a container of, not sort of an open, porous boundary, if you like. That is not the case in terms of what happens within those bricks and mortar and those buildings, but I understand why that would be a perception. Look, it's an ongoing challenge for us. The Chief Minister spoke around some of the infrastructure investments and, there's lots of things happening in our space that remove both physically and virtually those boundaries. We're working more and more in industry so that the idea of having a isolated academic institution like CIT, it's not just the bricks and mortar that you see around the five different campuses across Canberra. It's also in the workplaces. It's also in the universities. It's in the schools as well. It's always going to be a challenge for us in a sector that is trying to replicate exactly what industry needs right now in terms of the functionality and the equipment and the way that we actually teach, and not just for now but into the future. So we're always really keen and we work really well with industry and particularly your association, and take a lot of lead from you around what does that infrastructure need so that we can make sure our graduates are work ready with that infrastructure. A constant challenge, but I know in the school sector, I think the school sector possibly have done in the past, are doing that even better than the vet sector in terms of the infrastructure age of some of our assets.
Maybe just to add to Leanne's comment, I think as a newcomer to the system, you know, I get to sort of look at some things with fresh eyes. And one of the things that has really impressed me about the way the ACT education ecosystem works is how close the connections are. And I guess I'm not just talking about sharing of infrastructure and technologies and so on, but also in terms of the relationships between the schools and CIT, the schools and the two ANU and University of Canberra, and soon to be University of New South Wales coming, but with really significant and substantial partnerships that see, for example, University of Canberra in 25 of our schools supporting not just their own students, but also supporting the professional development of teachers who are there. And we have a range of really direct interactions into CIT on that sort of vocational education side. So I feel as though that sense of isolation or isolated blobs is far from what the reality has that I've seen in the last couple of months. In fact, it's been so much more... in the system that I came from, there were aspirations to have these kind of connections, and it's been astonishing to come here and see those connections in action.
Can I just say one thing? So I'll just give you one tiny campus. So the two Canberra campuses. It's been an absolute joy to see ANU open right up to the city. I mean, what, 10, 15 years ago, there was that terrible strip between the ANU and town, you know, never the twain shall meet. Now there's just a train road between the campus and the city. You almost can't tell where one begins and one ends. At UC, the integration of all those fantastic health facilities and, dare I say, am I going to get the code right? The Brumbies training facility, if I've got that wrong, I know I'm in big trouble. Anyway, football of some sort, rugby of some sort, really integrated into UC. But if you go somewhere else, you go to Victoria and look at a university like, say, Federation, that has both vocational and university education, they have sites in town and out of town, and in town they're a completely central part of the way the whole city works. They've got an enormous bakery, vet facility, they've got an enormous sort of engineering facility, and they're right in the middle of the community. I know that isn't quite addressing what you're saying, but I think our institutions have always been deeply embedded parts of community, and you can physically, through the way the infrastructure is and develops, you can see that more and more.
As I said, this conversation could go on, but we have to move on. That's been a really interesting conversation. There's a couple of things at a high level that have really struck me about what the three of you have had to say. One is that in the urgency we all feel, and education is one of those funny things, isn't it, where everybody thinks about education. If they've got children, they worry about it. They themselves are thinking about their own skill sets. So we all have this urgency for improving the system, and there's quite a lot of currency of some areas for change, some public debate. And you've all drawn us back to thinking about and not overlooking the strengths that we have in our systems. You know, when people my age went to university, that was 10% of the population. It's now closing on 40, and for women, it's over 40. You know, that's huge change. That's huge change. So you've reminded us not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, not to overlook that strength. And you've also drawn our attention to the extent to which the sectors are actually in vital conversation with each other. And that's and keen for engagement with business community and industry. And so there's some really interesting reminders there, and not that I don't think any of us would underestimate the urgency all three of you feel to see constant improvement on all those fronts. So I'd really like to thank you on behalf of people here today for your leadership, but also for what you've shared with us, your thoughtful kind of comments this morning, and on behalf of the audience to thank you.